You know, when you get a little soul at Crosspoint, it's great. And way to go. Thank you. It's one of those things that, you know, the words we just heard, the scene we saw in Modern Family, pride runs rampant through our lives. If you've been here over the last couple of weeks, if you're like me, you've probably been identifying every day how pride rears its ugly head in your life. I've been more hypersensitive to this over the last two or three weeks than I've probably been in a long time. And I think, in a certain way, this is God's way of really pointing out how deep the roots go in many, many aspects of my life. And so really glad you're here this morning as we're week three of In the Name of Love. My name's Kurt Walters. I'm the lead pastor here at Crosspoint. And, last week, Eric was right. We had a bathroom here on stage. In fact, it was supposed to be a replica of my bathroom. It was a replica. It wasn't all the real thing. Some pieces were from my bathroom. The toilet, no one ever did anything in it, right? That was new. It was clean. Even when he lifted the lid, somebody actually told me they wanted to walk up and sit on it during the service. I'm glad that they didn't. But, we really took a look last week at this whole idea of how, in many cases, pride begins in the bathroom. How it begins in this comparison game, how we seek after others valuing us or others accepting us based on how we present ourselves to others. And there's nothing wrong with looking good, but it comes down to the core question of, you know, where do I get my acceptance from? Is it from what other people say, how I project myself, or is it God just accepting that God loves me and gives me value because he created me? And then 2 weeks ago, we had a cubicle here on stage, part of my office, and took a look at how oftentimes pride shows up in the office, in the cubicle, and how that exhibits itself throughout our life. And today, we're going to go way, way back to the beginning of time. We're going to look way back where evil began and how it you know, kind of protrudes its roots forward into our lives today. And I want to talk a little bit about my pride here in the kitchen. This is actually my kitchen table right here. And so we've had this table for about 13 years, maybe 14 years. And so, you know, the head of the table, there comes a certain position with the head of the table. This is often where I sit. In fact, lately, I haven't been sitting here as much as I sit in this position because we have our two-year-old that sits here at times. And we keep the mess to one end of the table when we're eating. So she and I kind of shift places here. Macy will often sit there. My wife, Julie, sits here. Maggie will sit there. My son, Matt, sits at the other end. And you know, this is an interesting place because I've never sat down at this table and said, you know, I drive a Ford Expedition, or, you know, I drive a Pontiac Montana, because I don't know that anyone would want to say that. I've never sat here and said, I have a very important job, I'm a lead pastor, and it's very important. You know, I don't say things as stark as this, though, you know, when I, the kind of role that I carry, there's a certain expectation in my behavior with how I expect to be treated, with how I want people to speak to me, and there's certain behaviors that come out of me, certain treatment I expect, and I certainly don't want my kids to disrespect me as their father or their mother, and yet at the same time, I begin to realize that sometimes I get more offended than I should, even in this setting, because of my pride. In fact, just a few weeks ago, it was a crazy morning. We were getting breakfast ready, and I was kind of in and out of the kitchen. My wife had already left for work for the morning. I was supposed to get the kids on the bus, and we were running late, and I walk out of the kitchen to walk back in, and there was an open container of yogurt that someone had dropped, our two-year-old, I learned, all over the floor. You know how it hits, and it just, like, shoots? All over the place. I turn and see her with an open juice bottle in her arms, you know, just walking around. She's kind of walking, and every time she moves, it like spews out. And so I see puddles of juice, sticky juice and yogurt, and I'm like, guys, team meeting. I want to know who watched this? Who watched Meredith open the yogurt? Who watched her carry this juice bottle and absolutely destroy our kitchen? I just want to know who watched it and didn't say anything to me. It was dead silent. And then my son says, Dad, you were there the whole time. I said, no, I wasn't. You guys, watch this happen. Some people say I don't scream. I scream at home. I'm just warning you, I scream. And then all of a sudden I realize, oh, my word, you know what? I was here the whole time. Yeah, how quickly I begin to point the finger at other people, even with my own children. You see, what I began to realize is that, you know, I've noticed that many of the tensions in my family, not just with my immediate family, extended family, many of my tensions relationally in general come down to an issue of pride. I mean, many of them do. In fact, you know, when I judge other people, it comes down to pride. You know, our kids were young, younger. I remember hearing about families who never sat down or rarely sat down to have a family dinner. And we always sat down to have a family dinner. And I can remember, you know, just thinking, you know, how do you not sit down and have a family dinner with your, you know, with your kids? And now that our three oldest are older and they're engaged in a lot of extracurricular things and we're running in the evenings, it is not as frequent that our family gathers around this table. We do it as much as we can. We try to have a family dinner as often as possible, but it's not every night. And yet, I used to kind of set up and put myself in a high place and kind of look down my nose. I kind of get in a high and mighty place and just look down at others and just be like, how can they not do that? Man, I'm so much better than they are. I'm a better dad than they are. And you see, all of these tensions we have relationally often come down to our pride. And I've realized it's not just, you know, with in a family setting, in our marriages. Many of the tensions we have in our marriages come down to pride. Many of the tensions we have in our friendships, they often come down or can be traced back to an issue with pride. Many, many divorces that occur, somewhere along the lines, there was a root of pride that began to sprout up, and someone began to think that, you know, my feelings are more important than yours, or my role in this relationship is higher than yours, or I bring more to the table than you bring. And instead of saying, no, my role here is to simply come under you and serve you, I have to elevate myself. And you see, we don't like to be led. We like to be the one in charge. We don't like when we submit ourselves. And so, you know, today, I want to look at a story again, and this is one of the earliest stories in the Scripture. It's a story we look at a lot. In fact, we've already broke part of it down in week one of this series. It's the story of Adam and Eve, and you see, one of the reasons I think that some of us have a problem with the Bible, some of us even sitting here today have a problem with the Bible, is that we read this story about how Adam and Eve are tempted, how they succumb to temptation, how they fall, and how we blame God. And we read that, and we're like, you know, how did God put them there? I mean, don't you think that God knew what was going to take place in the garden? Don't you think he knew they were going to take the fruit? How could God set them up for failure? Now, I know that we come from different spiritual orientations and backgrounds into this place. It's what's really cool about this place. You can come and kind of make decisions for yourself as you kind of just come and receive and engage. And we have people that believe different things about Jesus, who Jesus is. We have people that walk out different things about their beliefs. And yet, one of the things I know that we have in common is there's probably an angst within us. For many of us, when we read this story for the first time, and we're like, you know, he says you can have everything. I mean, you can partake of all the fruits and the trees except for this one. And we're just like, God, why would you do that? Why would you set them up for failure? I mean, why would you do that knowing that most likely they're gonna do the one thing, it's like a three-year-old, that you asked them not to do, and then they're gonna fail and everything's gonna change? And even more so, not only is this the first time this happened, this is the second time that this happened in God's relationships. And you know, here's the deal. God wants most of all is a relationship with us. He wants nothing more. And you see, in order for there to be a relationship, there has to be a freedom. There has to be a freedom. There has to be free will, free choice. If there's not free will and free choice, then we're just like programmable human beings. It's like we're computer programs. God programs us, and we do exactly what he says. And while life might be have a little less mistakes in it if we were to do it that way, there's no free will. There's no reign. There's no choice. There's no choosing. It's impossible to have love if you can't choose something. And so love is dependent on the presence of freedom. And wherever there is freedom, there is the ability to choose poorly. And so God sets up this relationship right here with Adam and Eve, and this is the second time, right? This is the second time. The first was a relationship that went bad with his highest being, the being that he placed in charge of many of his angels. It was, in fact, in the Scriptures, there's this phrase called the angel of light. Some refer to this angel as Lucifer. Some refer to it as the devil. Some refer to it as Satan. And I'm going to talk about some things here in the next few minutes that are way, way out there. I'm going to be honest with you. Some of you are going to be like, man, this is way out there. But you may not believe everything I'm going to say, but these are some of the common themes that run throughout the Bible. And my hope is that as you hear some of this, you go, you know, you can at least go, you know, I'm not sure about all that, but at least you could say, you know, I experienced, though, the outcome of what he's talking about. I mean, I think you're going to at least be able to say that. So, you know, God had this created right-hand person that he created to oversee all of the heavens. His name was Lucifer, and he wasn't happy that he was here and God was up here. He wasn't happy that there was one more rung that he could step up to, but he was not there. And so, you know, he didn't like to be led. Lucifer didn't like to be second chair. And so, you know, he basically wanted to go up one more position. So he gathered all of the beings which he was over. He had this whole host of beings, these angels that he was over. He was overseeing. And he basically led a revolt against heaven, a civil war against heaven. And as a result of that, about a third of these angelic beings actually revolted against God. They chose poorly. They chose free will and said, I don't want to be connected with God. We want God's spot. We want to be up with God. And so they abused their freedom. They abused free choice by basically lifting themselves up to the spot of God. And God basically said, hey, I want nothing with that. And so he flacked them out and he sent them down, hurling down through the universe into planet Earth. And these angels that we have now are what are referred to as demons. So demons are simply just fallen angels. And so angels were once serving God, and now they're serving themselves. And so we read about them in Ezekiel. In fact, here's what it says in Ezekiel 28. It says, your heart became proud on account of your beauty. This is God speaking of these angelic beings that are now demons. Your heart became proud on account of your beauty. What he's basically saying here is, he said, the reason you become proud is because you look at yourself, you're like, man, we're all that. We're as good as anybody. We're all that. We got it going on. I got some capabilities. I've got some abilities. I'm totally sufficient on my own. I don't need to be led by anyone. I don't need to be submitting to anyone. I'm good on my own. He says, your heart became proud on account of your beauty, and you corrupted your wisdom because of your splendor. You see, what he's saying here is, you know, it started with bad thoughts. There are very, very smart people who have done incredibly dumb things because pride has come into the picture. You corrupted your wisdom because of your splendor, so I threw you to the earth, and I made you a spectacle before kings. So the very first relationship that God had was not between Adam and Eve, it was between Lucifer and himself. And it went bad because somebody said, hey, I want the top spot. I don't want to be under you, God. I want to raise myself up. I want to elevate myself. I don't want to be led. So fast forward that a bit to Adam and Eve. And here you have God saying to them, hey, you have this freedom. This is like try number two. You have this freedom, and you have freedom to do anything you want in the garden, eat from any tree in the garden, except for this one. And this one tree you need to just basically refrain from. And there's all kinds of reasons we could get into as to why that's the case. We don't have time to do a deep dive into that today. But as they're enjoying themselves, they're in the garden, they have free reign over everything, freedom with limits. They're naked. They don't even know that they're not clothed. I mean, everything is good. Everything's in harmony. And all of a sudden, Satan takes the form of a serpent and shows up on the scene. And he starts saying to Eve, he says, hey, God's really holding out on you. You know that, right? I mean, you know, he's not letting you take fruit from the one tree. That's him just kind of holding you down. Come on, Eve, let's be honest. I mean, you're smoking hot. I mean, you're the smartest person around right now. She's like the only other person around. You're the smartest person on the earth right now. I think God is afraid of what's going to happen if you actually take the fruit from that tree. I think God's just afraid of what's going to happen when you find out what that brings to you. In fact, here's how it played out in Genesis 3. The serpent says, you will certainly not die, the serpent said to the woman, for God knows that when you eat from it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. And he's like, come on, Eve, you're not going to die. God's holding out on you. Come on. Can't you see? This is a conspiracy against you. This is God not allowing you to have what's rightfully, duly yours. I mean, you're entitled to everything. And this is God basically saying, hey, I don't want you to have this. And if I can be honest with you, I think God's holding you down. I think God's holding you down. And so Eve's pride begins to swell up, and she begins to actually believe that. She's like, yeah, maybe God is holding out on me. Maybe I'm stuck here because God is holding me down. And if I take from that tree, then I'll go to new places. And so that's what she does. She decides to go to the tree. She picks the fruit. She eats the fruit. She hands it to Adam. He succumbs to the temptation. He eats the fruit. And immediately, it says their eyes are open. Immediately, their eyes are open. And all of a sudden, they have to do the fig leaf thing. You know why they would do the fig leaf thing? There's a number of reasons. One of them, I think, man, they thought, I'm all that. Man, I got it going on. And all of a sudden, they take the fruit of the tree, and they realize, I don't have it all going on. And so they start covering themselves up. Because here's what happens. The moment pride comes into the picture, you immediately begin to judge. Judgment is always a part of pride. It's always one of the arms of pride. You judge other people always. And so when we're prideful, we're always pushing ourselves up and pushing others down. And so one of the ways that we do this is we cover ourselves up. Like, man, I'm going to judge them, but I don't want them to judge me back because they may not see I don't have it all going on. You see, we do this all the time. We notice, you know, in other people, like, man, they don't have as hot a date as I've got. Or, man, their marriage isn't in as good a shape as mine. Or, man, they just don't have the work ethic that I have. I mean, we're through our day in, day out, hour by hour, we're constantly judging. Man, they just don't make good decisions. Man, if they use their money more wisely, they would have a much larger savings than they currently do. I mean, we come up with masterful ways of creating categories where we exalt ourselves and then use the leaves to cover ourselves up so others don't judge us. And so they're living like this for a bit. God comes back on the scene, and he's like, you know, I'm going to get to the bottom of this thing. So he goes, it is a very dramatic moment right here. God goes to Adam, and he says to Adam, he's like, Adam, you know, have you eaten from the tree? I mean, what's up with the fig leaves going on down there? And let's be honest, God knows what's going on, right? I mean, God knows what took place. God's trying to see if Adam will self-reveal what has taken place. But you know what? Pride doesn't allow us to do that. Pride does not allow us to self-reveal. You know what pride does? Deny, deny, deny. Denial becomes your key vocabulary word when pride is evident. And so there's no way. There is no way Adam is going to be revealing what took place. And so, no, you know, here's what he said. He said to God, he said, you know, God, the woman that, you know, you put down here with me, that woman is the reason that I'm where I am today. It was her, God. It was her. Really interesting right here. A few things about pride. Number one, pride produces judgment. Immediately, Adam goes to judgment. Second thing it produces is bitterness. Have you ever noticed that whenever bitterness is taking place in your life, whenever you're bitter about something, pride is the fuel that just keeps it burning. You know, there's a few years ago, before I was at Cross Point, I was on another staff team at another church, and our team went through some transition, and as a part of that, some of the leadership came to me and said, Kurt, you know, we would like you to take an increased role through this transition time, and they kind of outlined what it was going to require. It had, you know, my current responsibilities with some other responsibilities. It, you know, didn't have a whole lot of additional authority, but it definitely created more stress. And, you know, we prayed over, looked over, you know, considered it, said, yeah, you know, we want to do what's best for the church, and we'll do this, I'll take this on. And as I began to do it, I thought, man, this is a lot of extra work. I mean, there's a lot of extra things that I'm doing. And most people that enter into a role like this, they get an increase in pay, which they didn't offer to me. So, you know, I thought, man, it's like that's coming to me, right? I mean, that's a reasonable ask. So I went back to the leadership a few weeks later. I said, you know, man, guys, I'm happy to do this and privileged that you would consider me for this. And yet, you know, I'm wondering if you can allow my pay to reflect the role that you've asked me to take on. I think that's a fair, you know, that's my fair share just to ask that. I hate fair share thinking. I don't know why I was talking about it then. They said no. They said no. They said, we can't do that. And there were a variety of reasons that they were not in a position to do that. But man, that created bitterness in me. I mean, there was bitterness inside of me. There was a bitterness a resentment that I began to feel. You know, they're asking me to do this, and man, I should have more coming to me. If I was somewhere else, man, I'd be making more money than I am right here. And this bitterness began to play its way out in my life in ways that I was totally unaware of. Totally unaware of. You know, somebody dumps you, and you're bitter. I mean, pride sits in. You're hurt. You're like, man, what are they dumping me for? Man, I'm up here. They're down here. I mean, I should be the one dumping them. I mean, pride is an amazing way of always lifting us up and always pushing and hurting, pushing down someone else. Last summer, I took about a 2.5-week vacation. And that was the first time ever that I've been gone for 2.5 weeks from any job that I've worked. And that kind of came as a result of our governance team board chair saying to me, Kurt, you know, you need some extended time off. I really think you would benefit from, you know, not, and I take my vacation time, but I never take it in a larger chunk. And he said, I think you need to get away for an extended period of time. In fact, he still challenged me. He said, I'd love to see it grow to 3 or 4 weeks where it's some time with your family for a couple weeks and then some time to study for a couple weeks where you're not doing the normal routine leadership and teaching things that you do on a regular basis where you can really just enjoy some of life that you don't get the chance to enjoy like normal people do on weekends, and that's a challenge for me. I'm gonna be honest with you. As I'm contemplating that, as I'm thinking through, as we go forward, what that looks like for me, my pride immediately kicks in and resists that. You know why? Because I like to be seen as the one who's working hard. I like to be seen as somebody who's, you know, who doesn't need a break, who can work 65, 70 hours a week, 6 days a week. You know, I like to be, you know, as people say, man, you're always going, you're always clicking, you're always on it. Your work ethic is through the roof. That's what my pride wants. I love when people tell me that I work hard. I love it. And you see, I will drive myself at times to work more and more, not because I'm more productive, but because I just like the way that people see me working. And it can be very, very damaging. And to be honest with you, it actually creates some bitterness. It creates bitterness. And I know for some of you, you're sitting here thinking, man, I'd like your job. I'd like to take 3 or 4 weeks off in the summertime. And you're actually a little bitter about it right now. Well, let me tell you what, you can. You actually can, believe it or not. I mean, you might have to take a different job that's a little more flexible. Maybe a job that doesn't make as much money, but you could do it. In fact, for some of you, I know that at the end of the year, you always have vacation days that are in use. You don't take them because your pride tells you, why would I willingly take a day off and not work in a time when I could be working and people could be seeing how productive I am? In fact, others of you, you can actually purchase vacation time. You can actually go to your employer and purchase time off, but your pride does not allow you to. See, I find myself in this trap all the time, and it leads to bitterness. Third thing this leads to is pride begins to belittle. It begins to belittle. You know, it causes us to belittle other people. I mean, did you notice Adam said to God when God approached him? I mean, God's like, hey, Adam, you know what? Explain the fig leaves. I mean, why do you feel like you need to cover yourself up now? Did you guys take the fruit? And Adam's like, God, the woman you put here. God, I was perfectly fine. I was fine on my own. I would not have made this decision if you would have put that dame down here with me. Dame, that's an old word, right? Dame? Like, I haven't used that in a long time. If you wouldn't have done this, then I would not have done this. God, this is actually your fault. I ate the fruit because of you. How many of us have found ourselves in this position right here? Because of you. I mean, think about this. The audacity of this right here. Adam is actually belittling God. I mean, Adam has free will, free choice. He can make any choice that he wants, and yet he's finding himself pointing the finger at God, belittling God for the problems he's now experiencing in his life, and he chose him. I mean, look at Eve on the other hand. I mean, you know, this plays out, and Eve, you know, God's like, I'm going to get a different picture. I'm not sure if this all played out. So he goes to Eve, and he says, Eve, you know, what's your version of the story? And she's like, well, you know, the serpent made me do it. It's his fault. It's not my fault. I hate the word, it's not my fault. I put one of my kids in timeout yesterday for saying, it's not my fault. I hate the word. Eve's saying, it's not my fault. It's not my fault. The serpent, God, which, by the way, nudge, nudge, you put down here, I didn't create the serpent. I don't know why the serpent would be here. God, you put that serpent down here. He made me eat the fruit. It's because of you, God, that I did this. I mean, the story's filled with belittling God. Belittling. You see, the fourth thing we end up finding out is that pride actually blames. We find ourselves in this blame game constantly. Not only do we belittle, we blame. Pride judges, pride produces bitterness, pride belittles, pride blames. You see, we like to blame all of the problems in our life on somebody else or something else. We never own it. We never can really say, you know, I have a free will in this situation right here. And one of the most beautiful things about the story of the whole Bible, the story of God, the gospel, the good news, the story of Jesus, is that, you know, Jesus really lives out the entire life cycle of everything that Adam and Eve experienced. He lives it all. In fact, God declares some consequences to Adam and Eve and the serpent. He says, Adam, from this day forward, because of what you've done in the garden, there's going to be a consequence. You're going to have to work for your wages. You're going to have to work for the things that you want. You're going to have to labor after those things. You're going to labor hard. You're going to plant things and weeds are going to pop up. You're going to plant things and you're going to think, man, this should produce something that I want, and it's going to be hard. It's not always going to go the way you want. You're going to have very much frustration in your labor. This is one of the reasons that for us today, you know, we put the work in, we do, you know, we go buy the book on the sales call, trying to win an account, and we say, man, I nailed that. I mean, it couldn't have been done any better, and yet we still lose the account. It's why, you know, we develop the perfect business plan for the business we want to start, and we execute it precisely, and yet things don't take off. Because God says, hey, you're going to labor after things, and it's going to be empty and hollow at times. It's just one of the consequences. It turns to Eve. And he says something to her. And now you can believe this, whether or not this happened or not, but this is just what it says in Genesis chapter 3. He says to Eve, Eve, from now on, when you give birth to children, it's going to be a pain. It's going to be a pain. He said, I birthed you, Eve, and you have caused me a pain. You have caused me pain. It's one of your consequences is when you birth children now, as a reminder of the free will and the choice that you chose a different path, there's going to be pain in childbirth. Then he turns to the serpent, the third figure in this story, and he says, you know what, from now on, I'm taking away your legs. From now on, you're going to crawl with your belly along the ground. You're just going to be a lowly belly. I'm going to put you down on the ground, and there's going to be this enmity between you and the woman. I mean, there's going to be this thing between you for the rest of humanity. And by the way, there's eventually going to be somebody who comes, this Messiah who's going to come, and he's going to come, and he's going to crush your head, Satan. He's going to crush you. You see, what he's saying right here is he's actually doing a prophecy right here, a foretelling of what's eventually going to come. You see, Jesus is going to come from up on high. Jesus is in heaven. He's basically saying he's going to lower himself down. He's going to take on the form of flesh and love, just like human beings. He's going to go through the entire life cycle that Adam and Eve went through. He's going to be tempted in every way. He's going to know what it feels like to be tempted. The only difference is he's not going to succumb to the temptation. He's not going to give in to the temptation. And yet, as only he can humbly do, he's going to take on the sin and the weight of the entire humanity. He's going to go to a cross and pay the price. He's going to humble himself. He's going to take on all of the things that everyone else deserves, and he's going to break the curse. He's going to break the curse. He's going to stomp on the head of Satan right here. He's going to crush the power source. He's going to crush the power that keeps the roots planted deep in our lives. And he's going to remove that. And there's numerous references to this throughout the scriptures. In fact, in Philippians 2, here's one. Paul says he humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. Now, listen, he's not talking about dying in an old man's, old folks' home right here, all right? That's like the way you and I think of dying. We're going to go out, you know. And this is like humiliating. My grandmother's in an old folks' home, and you know, they take really good care of her. This is humiliating right here. He's gonna go to a cross. This is the most humiliating point or execution style known to human beings. And he's gonna be put up there naked. All right? The way you see it in the movies with the loincloth, that's not how it happened. They don't give him a loincloth. He is stark naked, as humiliated as one could be. People are going to come and spat on him. They're going to spit on him. They're going to scourge him. They're going to hurl insults at him. They're going to beat him. And he's going to take that all as a response to him. I'm going to break the head of Satan. And so Jesus just says, I'm going to take that. I'm going to do this for you. I'm going to humble myself. I'm going to take all of this on. I mean, the death on a cross was the most excruciating form of death. In fact, that's where we get the word excruciating is actually from the root word crucifix. Crucifix is the root of excruciating. He humbled himself, became obedient to death, even on a cross. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name. You know, have you ever noticed how Jesus, the name Jesus, carries a lot of weight? I mean, you mentioned Jesus in circles, and man, people stop and listen. And if you've never experienced this, just, you know, next time you're at like a small party or something, walk in the room and just go, Jesus! And people are like, whoa, is he cussing? Is he worshiping? I'm not sure what he's doing right there, but it's one of the two, right? Now, if you don't believe me, go into a room this afternoon and go, Ted! People look at you like you're crazy, and then they'll keep going on. Helen! It doesn't carry the same weight. You know, the name Jesus carries a weight. In fact, every tongue and tribe in, you know, even out in the bush somewhere on the other side of the world, even people who don't have a Bible, in nearly every case, every tribe across the world knows at least what the name of Jesus means. There's a weight that comes with it. He says, you know, God says, I'm going to exalt him to the highest place, give him the name that is above every name, the name of Jesus. Every knee will bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. You know, I can remember when I was eighth grade or so, when I first became a Christian and began following Christ, you know, and began to kind of declare that I was following Christ. I began to share this with some of my friends, and they would say a phrase to me I hated. They'd say, you know, you're following Jesus. Jesus is just a crutch. And I'd be like, no, he's not. No, he's not. Uh-uh. I mean, that's like my eighth grade. You know, that's where I was right there. I'm like, no, he's not. That's the best I had to come back. No, he's not. He's your crutch. I hated that. I hated this idea of Jesus being referred to as a crutch. I'm like, no, I don't need a crutch. I'm like a manly boy. You know, I don't need a crutch. Sissies take crutches. I'm perfectly fine on my own. I made a very intelligent decision. I'm smart, you're dumb. That helped a lot. I'm smart, you're dumb. I made a very intelligent decision of just accepting something that I saw that was true. It's not a crutch. It's not a crutch. And it was interesting because, you know, as time went on, as I continued to read the Bible and kind of mature in my faith, I began to realize, you know, that I viewed it a bit different. In fact, here's how I even view it today. What I should have said to them was, you know, no, Jesus isn't my crutch. No, he's not my crutch. He's my stretcher. He's actually my stretcher. You see, when you think you need a crutch is like, hey, I'm good. I'm good. I just got a little limp right here. I need a crutch to kind of help me get around. I'm 90% good on my own, just need 10% of Jesus. You know, when I need a crutch, you know, a crutch is like, hey, Jesus is my co-pilot. I mean, I'm the pilot here. I'm driving the ship. I just look at what Jesus says in the Bible, and I just kind of take that, and then I go do it on my own power. That's a crutch. What I began to become aware of was, I mean, I'm dead. I don't need a crutch, man. I am dead. I am dead in my sin, dead in my transgressions. There's nothing I can do or project or dress that allows me to be worthy of God. I am flat out dead. In fact, I'm dead like I'm laying on the ground and somebody on the battlefield comes with a stretcher to come pick me up. In fact, I probably ought to get down there right now. The only reason I'm probably not is because my pride doesn't allow me to lay down on stage. You know, I'm dead in a stretcher. So let me just do it because I'll regret this later. I'm dead. I'm like right here. I realize I'm right here. I mean, I may be doing things over here in the financial world and, you know, looking good and making some good calls and showing how successful I am. Or I may be, you know, in the entrepreneur world, you know, building stuff over here. But I'm just dead. None of that stuff can lift me up high enough. In fact, it only just pushes me down. And I realize, man, it's only when I realize, man, I am just laying here. Man, I don't need a crutch. I actually need I need a stretcher. I need somebody to come. I need somebody to come that actually can take me to a new place, not just, like, keep me hobbling along with a little help along the way. Man, I need somebody to transport me and say, man, I'm dead. I'm dead, and I need to be taken to an entirely new place. I need my marriage to be taken to an entirely new place. I need my relationships with my kids to be taken to an entirely new place. See, it's only when we see Jesus as a stretcher that he has the ability to take us when we humble ourselves and we realize, man, I am dead. I'm dead. And so I realize, you know, this lands a lot of places for us today. And so I want you to take out your connection card that we referred to earlier. In fact, take out your whole weekly. I want you to hold both of these pieces right now. And on the back of your connection card, there are some next steps on there. And every week here at Crosspoint, we help give you some next steps, just some things that will help you maybe, you know, say, you know, where am I going to go with this? What am I going to do? What's the step I need to take? Where am I belittling people? Where am I blaming? Where is pride just rooted so deeply that, man, it's destroying me, and I'm just limping along, and I need Jesus to come, and I need to lay on that stretcher and say, man, I'm dead right here. I am dead on my own. I need to be taken to a new place. Maybe for some of us that have always been the one saying, oh, Jesus is a crutch. That's why I've never believed him. And you're just realizing, man, it's not a crutch. I am dead, man. There's a lot of deadness in me right now. There's no affect in me. And I need a God who comes and doesn't just help me limp along a little. I need a God who can transport me to a new place. So as you look over those, take a moment and just identify. Say, you know, here's my next step this week. And then in your weekly, here's the next step. I was reminded of this by somebody this week. You know, we walk out of here and don't remember our next steps. On the bottom of your notes page every week, there's a place for you to write my next step today. So just jot yourself a note. You don't have to write the whole thing down. Just write a reminder. Here's what I'm walking out this week. So take a few moments and do that. In these moments, we're making very spiritual decisions right now. Maybe with our eyes open, maybe closed, but we're deciding how we're going to walk this out. We're deciding how we're side, and, you know, if we're tired of limping along and we're ready to accept that, you know, we're nothing. I mean, we are nothing. We are dead. That we have behaviors and actions and words that come out of our mouth that it causes us to be dead. There's little we can do to repair, but God, you have the ability to pick us up and take us to a new place, take our relationships to a new place, take us individually to a new place. God, for some of us today, God, maybe for the first time, we're realizing that, man, all you're really interested in is a relationship. You give us free choice, free will, because it doesn't mean anything if you choose for us. And so maybe we're seeing for the first time that it's only when I humble myself and realize, man, I am dead, that you can actually begin to do something in my life. So I pray, God, that in these next moments, as we remember that sacrifice, as we celebrate it, God, that you would just make this be very real for us. Help us to experience it, to hear it, to taste it. Meal we're going to share in here in the next few moments. Some call it the Eucharist, some call it the Mass, some refer to it as the Holy Communion. And you know, it's been done for thousands of years among people who follow the heart of Christ. And you know, I talked about how at this table, our dining room table, how oftentimes my pride reveals itself at the table. And what's interesting to me is that, you know, when Jesus gathered at a table like this with his closest friends, he's somebody who actually probably, was entitled to be entitled. Let's be honest. He never gave in to temptation. And here he is getting ready to pay the largest price possible. And you got to think there were moments where he could have said, guys, I'm not doing this. God, I'm up there with you, God. What am I doing down here? I mean, I'm entitled to sitting up there with you, and I'm down here paying the price for these screw-ups down here. Come on. But you know what? He didn't do that. No, the one who could have been entitled wasn't entitled. In fact, he took on the role as a servant. In fact, it says, there's one verse where it says, you know, while you and I were still out sinning and screwing around and doing our own thing, God was busy paying for our sacrifice. I mean, you know, sometimes I'm like, man, my kids don't even get it. They're still doing the thing that I keep telling them not. They're right in the middle, right doing it right now. I mean, that's like God. He's like, well, while we were still sinning, God's paying our price. Talk about somebody who could have been entitled. And so as he sat there with his friends, he took the bread off the table and he made a connect with it. He said, you know, from this point forward, every time you eat this bread, I want you to remember my body that was broken for you. That's why in some circles this is called the Mass, because it's literally taking in the Mass of Christ, and I'm giving myself to you, all of myself to you. I give everything I have to you when you receive me and begin a relationship, and I take all of you, all of your stuff, all of your sin, all of your brokenness. I take it. I own it. I paid for it. And then he took the cup off the table, the common cup, and he gave thanks, and he offered it to them, and he said, from this point forward, he said, this is the blood of the new covenant, which is poured out for many. And he really did it for everyone, but he only knew that some would receive it. Because you see, this is only for those who have entered relationships. So when you enter relationship, then you receive my grace. That's what it's about. So he says, this is about how I broke my life for you. I gave my blood for you. I shed my life source so that you could have life. It's the only way life can be renewed. And so this is for those of us who have chosen to be in relationship with Jesus, who are saying, hey, I know that grace. I've freely chosen to receive this kind of grace. And so if that's not where you are today, as many come forward in the next few minutes and share the bread and the cup at the tables, I'm going to ask you to just sit where you are and observe and watch. There's going to be a lot of movement, so you can be very inconspicuous. And yet at the same time, maybe today for the first time, you're realizing, man, this God is a God who just simply wants to know me. And when I begin to realize, I mean, I am totally dead. There's nothing I can do. I'm dead. And I don't just need somebody to help me limp along. I need somebody to come on a stretcher and take me away. If that's where you are, then God says, man, then let's begin today. He says, you know, by receiving my grace, by accepting me as the Lord, the person that's up here in your life and putting yourself down here, he says, that's how we begin. So I invite you, if that's where you are, to come and take your first communion. And as a part of that, say, God, this is my prayer. I want to receive your grace. I want to make you Lord of my life. And as we do this, we're going to sing a song here that is one of my favorites. It's a song we do frequently here at Crosspoint. It's called How He Loves. And I think that the reason I love it, there's one line in this song that just gets me every time. And it's this line that says, you know, I don't have time to maintain my regrets when I think about the way that he loves. Your regret is fed out of bitterness. But when we choose to move out of bitterness, you know, we don't have time to maintain that anymore. as we think about the extravagant love of the Father. So let's stand to our feet. And as we sing, I'm going to invite you to come to the table down the center aisle. And as you do that, you can make your way to the table on either side. You can take a piece of bread. You can dip it in the cup. You can take as long as you would like. And then you can return to your seat. As a part of this, we're remembering and we're celebrating the death and the resurrection of Jesus, who gives us freedom.